Dom Knight, welcome you to another episode of Double Disillusionist. Sorry it's been a little while between updates. What you're about to hear is a live show recorded on the 4th of July and consequently devoted to US politics. We're joined by Dr. David Smith of the US Study Centre at Sydney Uni, who regularly appears on radio and TV to talk about American politics, and Dr. Amanda Tattersall, also of Sydney Uni. She's the host of the Changemakers podcast, which you should go and subscribe to right now, and she's an expert in community movements, organising, and that kind of thing, and she's going to tell us all about some of the response that sprung up to the Trump administration in the community. Don't forget, we do these events on the first Tuesday of every month, and we only podcast the first half of them. The second half gets a little bit looser. In order to enjoy that, you'll have to come in person. Plenty to talk about in Australian politics at the moment, so we'll have a regular episode for you very soon. In the meantime, please enjoy this live event. Please make them very welcome, David Smith and Amanda Tattersall. So let's just go back to the day when Donald Trump became President of the United States. What was it like? David, you were doing commentary throughout the day.
That was the worst birthday of my life.
That's right.
Yeah, I was doing ABC's The World Today between 12 and 3, which was basically the 3 hours that it became very clear what was actually going on. I was following this particular graphic on the New York Times that had this dial indicating the probability of a win. And when I first tuned in, it was sort of hovering around the 85% mark for Clinton, and then it just started shaking.
As did
this
we
way.
All.
And it was clear that nobody at the ABC grasped what was actually going on. They still kept playing these packages, which essentially indicated that it was in the bag for Clinton. And I had to speak to the producer at about 1:30, showing her the wobbling dial, which by this point was wobbling towards Trump, saying, you know, this is actually going to happen. And I just remember the silence around the studio. And when I went back there 3 months later, people looked at me like I was a condemned man or a survivor of some terrible event or something like that. It was...
You were Jonah. They were going to throw you overboard.
Yeah. It was certainly a very strange day. I didn't expect Trump to win. But as I said before the election, you know, I was happy to predict a Clinton win because if Trump won, getting a prediction wrong was going to be the least of my worries. And that has certainly proven to be the case. On the day, the thing that I was actually most worried about was the rapid norms deterioration that Trump would bring. And the behaviour at Manning Bar that day was symptomatic of that. All of these boys who were suddenly like, our man is in charge of the world now. Mm. All our behaviour, which has been suppressed, which we've been told is wrong, it's all fine now. Who's going to stop us now? And certainly in the hours and days that followed the election, I lived in Michigan for 7 years. I've got a lot of close friends there who were freaking out on election night, the tears vomiting, deep, deep fear. Just monitoring what was going on in Michigan over the next few days. An incident at a high school where Hispanic students were barricaded from the school by students shouting, Trump, Trump, Trump. Multiple assaults in the city of Ann Arbor, where I used to live. A Michigan policeman turning up at an anti-Trump demonstration with a Confederate flag on his car. Gosh. Just all of this kind of behavior. I mean, this was what I really feared in the immediate aftermath. All of this kind of behaviour that Trump had licensed. And I remember thinking that one of the most important things over the next few months would just be that the rule of law held together and that law enforcement would actually kind of not succumb to the pressure of the norms erosion that would be taking place around the country. I don't want to boost the ego of any lawyers any more than I have to, but I knew that that was going to become the most important profession in the United States for a while as people started to organise defence against what Trump was going to try to do. Now, 6 months on, it's very fortunate that actually a lot of what I feared has not come to pass. A lot of norms have actually held up fairly well, although not completely well. You know, and the rule of law does seem to be holding up. But, you know, every time something happens like Trump sacking James Comey, I do feel a little bit sick. That is another You know, that's another attack on the rule of law. That's another attack on democratic laws. So, in summary, yes, November 9th, as it was for us, will always be a deeply traumatic day for me. Unfortunately, that will always be my birthday.
Yeah, you might have forgotten to factor in how deeply hopeless he's proved to be at governing. Got so little time. We'll get onto that. Amanda, how about you? Now, you lived in New York City for quite a few years, Trump Central, but then again, he's sort of not of New York City. There was a great article this week, I think, on Politico that described how he was made in the 70s and 80s in New York, where it was all scary and he went up in his golden tower and was not part of it, and he kind of hates cities, and we saw that through the campaign. How does that day, Trump's victory, gel with the America that you know so well?
Well, there isn't really one America, and I think that that's probably the most important thing to understand about the Trump election is actually it's an incredibly diverse place. And, you know, New York City was as disappointed about Trump's election as most of us were, right?
80%, I think.
Some crazy statistic, right? But if you go outside of the main urban centres in the United States and outside the classic blue states, you see a completely different environment. And there is, whether it's the ravages of globalisation that's ripped the heart out of people's sort of sense of economic security, or if it's the tendency towards hoping that religion and religious institutions are going to be a saviour for people's sense of hope, and that creates a connection to a more conservative politic. There's a very different sense of America in those communities, and I think that they're in many of the Rust Belt states that voted for Trump, in the Midwest, which is also diverse, but one of the most surprising outcomes is that Michigan, as you described, but also Wisconsin voted for Trump. You see massive levels of alienation and lack of hope, and you see a fear of the unknown. You see a fear of both, you know, the Latino population. You see a fear of Muslims that Trump was able to exploit to help get himself into the White House.
Were you surprised?
Well, we had a bit of a disagreement in my home about this issue. It was funny when it came to dealing. I normally think of myself as, you know, super sophisticated about politics and know what's going on, right? But I couldn't stomach Trump, and whenever I would watch, and I still can't, but when I would watch him in the debates, I found his tone and method so offensive that I couldn't actually feel like I had lost any sense of the ability to be objective about him as a candidate, and just decided that he couldn't win on sort of a normative thing. He shouldn't win, so therefore he wouldn't. In contrast, my husband, I think initially thought he may do some comedy stuff, and he thought it would be hilarious.
I work with him. His name's Charles Firth. Whether he does comedy stuff is open to interpretation.
He tries, right? You know, like, but
he certainly does.
He thought it would be hilarious early on if Trump won, and went over to the US 3 times to amuse himself with how crazy he was. And two things happened. One is that he was of the opinion that Trump might win, and that certainly informed my own analysis. The second thing was is that he went to a Trump rally where Trump was on stage, and there were some protesters in the crowd, and Trump literally called from the stage that, you know, if there's another protester, someone should hit him. There was another protester, and someone smacked him out. Like, and Charles was saying at the time, there's a Nuremberg feel to these events. This is not... And so he started to get scared as well, which was both a relief because I thought, please, let's not joke too much about this. But, you know, but Charles always thought he would win. And he was right, frighteningly.
Yeah, Charles wanted me to say that he called it first in Australia on Channel 10. What's not recorded is whether or not he was joking at about 1 p.m. when he made that call. But no, I remember that because I was giving updates to Manning Barr at the time, and looking at the same thing, I'd get off stage and look at the little graph on the New York Times, and they were kind of new because they'd lost 538 and they were trying to make up for it with a new thing called the upshot, and I was kind of like, this is ridiculous, they're hopeless. They were right. They were completely right. So, so we've gone on for there. Andrew, what are your memories of all of that?
I drank really heavily.
Is that a very healthy
really
response?
Heavily. Like I was. Yeah, I went through two bottles pretty much that day because it seemed like such a slam dunk. I think mainly the reasons that you pointed out that. Because it seemed like something that shouldn't happen. All of the things that should normally have disqualified Trump from being a candidate, let alone being the candidate, it sort of just seemed to me to be like, well, he's not going to, you know, he's boasting about sexual assault. They're never going to elect someone who boasts about sexual assault.
I forgot to check the room for balance, by the way. If there are any Trump supporters in, by all means, give a hell yeah at this point and we'll... Stand Redfern audience? Okay, fine, let's move on.
We won't goad other members of the crowd to hit you.
So look, let's flash forward to now and where we are. And in terms of what's actually unfolded in the 6 months since then, I'm interested to know how has the reality compared to what you feared?
Yeah, because I think that my statement was that the probability of Trump winning was about the same probability as losing a game of Russian roulette. The apocalypse hasn't happened, and I don't think it will happen. It's just that things could get a hell of a lot more unpleasant. People like to compare Trump to foreign dictators, past and present. You know, Putin, Hitler in some cases. These are bad comparisons, and especially in the US, it speaks to the unwillingness of Americans to see there's actually a very distinctly American tradition of authoritarianism in Trump. And you only need to go back 40 years to a time when the United States wasn't even a complete democracy. And that is what Trump is appealing to.
Are you talking
to.
About civil rights when you make
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't until the 1970s that Mississippi finally properly enfranchised African Americans, that the Mississippi Democratic Party actually stopped rebelling against the National Democratic Party. You don't have to go back very far to find a down-at-home tradition of American authoritarianism. I remember once when I was doing my PhD, I was reading about this governor of Texas in the 1950s, Alan Shivers, who ran for governor successfully in the 1950s on the platform that communists in Texas should get the electric chair. If you're a member of the Communist Party, you get the electric chair.
And I remember Menzies didn't go that far.
Yeah, and I remember going to my...
That was McMahon.
Yeah, I remember going to my PhD advisor who was from Texas and going, holy shit, this is incredible. And he just looked at me and said, you've got to understand that you're the historically unusual one here, right? This idea that we don't just kill our enemies, that's historically unusual.
Game of Thrones is a documentary about the history of the world.
And I mean, Trump is hailing back to that era of America.
I think hailing back, yeah.
What? I suppose one of the things that made Trump so effective as a campaigner was his amateurism. He was not polished. He did whatever he said or felt like, and that communicated an entirely false sense of authenticity to his supporters, but one they bought into very deeply. He used these incredibly old-fashioned campaign techniques of mass rallies and distributing baseball caps. He didn't spend a lot
Made
of money
in China.
On political consultants. Yeah, he didn't advertise, or he didn't spend as much on TV advertising. Now, the fact that Trump was... able to win an election doing that. I mean, it turns out he's one of the most canny campaigners of the 21st century. And he also knew where he had to win, and he was just relentlessly focused on those areas. And one of the reasons he surprised the polls so much and took people like me completely off guard was because he brought people into the political process in places like the Midwest who'd been so alienated from it for so long. But that amateurism does not work in government. And as naive and inexperienced and completely uninterested as he is in learning anything about the world, most of the people he's surrounded himself with are the same. And, I mean, if you think about the difficulty that Obama had negotiating with a Congress, a House of Representatives and a Senate that was dominated by Democrats... Trump has had exactly the same problems, except far, far worse because Obama put in the work. Trump has not. So Trump's amateurism is currently what is standing, to dramatically overstate the case, between the world and the apocalypse.
You can't find the button.
Yeah.
Well, this is, I think this is one of the things that I think for Australians in particular would find so confusing is that the difference between a presidential system and the Westminster system that we've got, because if you are the Prime Minister and you have control of both houses, you get to do what you want. Whereas, and so, you know, ostensibly we have a Republican president, we have two houses of Congress dominated by the Republicans. Why isn't anything getting through?
Well, Obama couldn't do it either.
Well, Obama at least had people from the opposite party.
No, his first 2 years.
This is the paradox of presidential power. The president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world, and yet one of the least powerful heads of government in the world, vis-a-vis their own government. The president does not sit in the legislature. A prime minister in a Westminster system, as long as they command a majority, they can get stuff through pretty much however they want. That's why the American founding fathers called the Westminster system an elected dictatorship. They wanted a system that in which it would be very hard to get anything done unless there was consensus. When we talk about American politics failing, that failure was built into the system by deeply conservative founding fathers. Right,
there they were got two, it right in this case, though, didn't they?
Yeah, two factions.
It's a feature, not a bug.
That's right. There were two factions of the Constitutional Convention. One wanted a very strong, centralised federal government. One wanted no government at all. Their compromise was, let's have a government that doesn't work.
So that's all true, right?
Yeah.
That's all true. But there is something very similar that's happened in both America and the Westminster system of Britain around politics, right? America had Trump and then the sort of malaise of post-election. And Britain had the Brexit election and then the blowback of the last of Theresa May's last attempted election.
So dumb. Amazing.
Election does feel like a strong word.
Yeah. And I think that there's something in both of those elections about an emotional candidate. In both elections, you might have had a bumbling fool at the top, right, with both Brexit and Trump. You also had Cambridge Analytica. I don't know if anyone's heard of Cambridge Analytica, but Cambridge Analytica use psychometric Facebook mapping to be able to know what each of you are thinking and liking on Facebook and then targeting messaging to you based on what you like. And
they're doing it to you right now.
They probably would like to. They came to Australia in April to try and pitch to the Liberal Party. And so we'll see what happens in the next election. Maybe they tried to pitch to Corey Bernardi. God knows he needs help, right? Like,
don't they just have to jump onto the dark web and buy all that?
Alexander Hicks.
Okay. Yeah.
And he played a role in both the Brexit election and in Trump's election, doing all this sort of psychometric targeting and sort of evil manipulation, you know, hand of God. But I think your point is the point is that's fine for an election where you can scare people and provide people limited information. But the day after, when the facts dawned, like when people started Googling what does the European Union mean in Britain, which they did to the point that it trended, people realise that they've sort of been fooled by these electoral systems. And so in some ways there's populism, right? So Trump is an example of right-wing populism. Brexit is an example of right-wing populism. And then there's like the wake of populism where there seems to be a different kind of politics that can play out in that space that I think is interesting to what then happens in America and similarly what then happens in the UK.
Well, I think Corey Bernardi is an example of right-wing unpopulism. So now, I'm interested to ask you, though, Amanda, given what David was saying about, I guess the traditional ruling elite in America, people who look a lot like me, who had been told for years, you know, that they were wrong, I'm wondering if this is, in a sense, a bounce back, a kind of backlash to all of the years of civil rights, all the progress that's been made, and in particular someone like Barack Obama. I wonder if this is, given that it's going to be hard to sustain, to replicate what's happened just now. Is this sort of the last kind of dying gasp of that?
Look, I'm not an end of history kind of person. Like, I like to more try and understand how things are going to play out in terms of whether people are organised or not. And what I mean by organised is whether people are involved and connected into communities where they feel like they have a sense of power over their own lives. And I think that what you see in terms of the poorer working class white community, white male communities, that some of what you're talking about, that there is a lack of community in those areas. But if they were organised, as in if the union movement, which was strong over the last 60 years in the United States, was stronger in places like Pittsburgh, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, that some of those communities wouldn't have had this kind of backlash. But as an alienated white dude where you're just watching Fox News, you're more susceptible to interpreting the world through what you receive from the media, whether it's Facebook or TV, than you are than if you are able to interpret it in, say, your local union chapter, where you're able to talk these issues through person to person. The problem, I think, across the Midwest and is a lack of organisation. And so, therefore, the solution, I don't think, is hoping that this is the sort of a dead cat bounce for white men, which it might be, Dom, and I'm just, you know, sorry to hear for it for you, you know. Yeah. But
thank goodness we're back for a bit.
But what I think is where the solution lies is in better organising strategies.
I think Tony Abbott deserves a little bit of credit though, because come on.
How did we get here?
Does he know?
Let me just this is the thing.
You're always saying
I don't
that
think
in
this has been stressed enough. Was it before David Cameron's Brexit election, before Donald Trump, he was the pioneer of the guy who harnessed generic miscellaneous anger at the status quo, got elected and didn't know what the fuck to do. Like, he was there. He was there years before Trump and Theresa May.
He's the avatar of people who believe that Western civilization was perfected in the Riverview dressing rooms in the 1970s.
I'm sure they're very good dressing rooms. All right, so... as you were saying, David, he's proven quite hopeless in office so far. He seems to simply get angry rather than actually be constructive and try and solve things. Let's dive into some of the things going on in America, some of the debates going on, where despite him claiming that he's been the most effective president in 6 months ever, the scoreboard is extraordinarily poor. He hasn't he's put through a bunch of regulations. Sure, he's got a Supreme Court justice, but which they stole, but anyway. But in terms of major legislative...
To be fair, he has tweeted so much more than Reagan did.
That's true. But in terms of how they're actually going and rolling out their program, firstly, there seems to be a lot of internal dissent about what that is. And secondly, they've been hopeless. So how are they travelling? Let's start with you, David, in terms of the Trump agenda such as it is.
Well, the big issue that was always going to dominate the first 2 years was healthcare. Republicans had spent 7 years saying that their major aim was repealing and replacing Obamacare. Trump did not mention healthcare in his inauguration address. He admitted very early on that it was far more complicated than he realised. He hasn't made a huge effort ever since then to really get very involved in it, despite since having changed his position to, I know more about healthcare than anyone. The Republicans really are the dog that caught the car in this case. They have spent 7 years building a massive base of anger and resentment and donations on the idea that Obamacare death panels are killing the country.
Gotta hate people who try to give me health care. It's just I will not ride in an ambulance.
After Obama left office, Obamacare is more popular than it has ever been before. And now Republicans...
Well, it's all the people employed by those death camps.
Yeah. Now Republicans suddenly face the reality that they have to come up with something, what Donald Trump promised, something amazing. Now there are enough...
That's going to be cheaper and better for everyone, wasn't that what he said?
There are enough hardcore ideologues in the House of Representatives. People who have to get elected every 2 years are often in very safe districts, and their bigger problem is primary challenges from the right. There was a big enough Republican majority there to come up with a very, very nasty bill that will throw 20 million people off insurance and to pass it. The Senate, on the other hand, these are people who need to get elected every 6 years. They've got a far more long-term view. And the Senate at the moment, if you were a cynical observer, you would say Mitch McConnell is trying to engineer a bill that will fail because he knows, he knows what the consequences actually could be for the Republican Party. So, I mean, this comes back to this thing about, yes, they've got control of both houses of government. They've got the president. They've got a majority back in the Supreme Court. Why can't they do this? Because they understand what the consequences could actually be.
There's also been a lot of opposition. Amanda, I might get you to comment on this too, about the campaigning that's going on that's working pretty well.
Well, so I was going to tell you about the secret story behind why healthcare has been so difficult. So about 2 days after the election, there was a dinner party in Southern California, and there were a couple of people who'd been ex-Congress staffers, all Democrats, and a union person. And they were despairing about what a disaster it was, like the rest of us. And they decided that they wanted to put together a playbook for your average organiser, campaigner, activist type of person about how you could replicate for the left the strategies that the Tea Party used for the right. So they started writing a Google Doc, as you do. And
Southern California, of course they did.
Yeah. Of course they did, you know. So they wrote this Google Doc. It was about 30 or 40 pages long, and they tweeted it out. It was like, here's some tips for how to campaign against the terrible Trump arena. Let's be indivisible in our fight against him. Tweet. And so it went absolutely bananas. And all these celebrities started tweeting it out. It went bananas around. To the point that the people who wrote this now famous indivisible document started getting contacted by people to go, oh, can you set up a website? So they set up a website. Oh, can you put your document on the website? They put the document on the website. Oh, can we affiliate with your organisation? Can we set up affiliate groups to be indivisible groups? Sure, sure, sure. So there are now 4,000 indivisible groups across the United States. They are in every single congressional district in the United States. And the playbook gave these groups a way to organise. They said, what you should do is you need to organise a local group, obvious. You need to intervene into the activity of any local congressional person in your area. You need to intervene into their media. So when they do a doorstop, you turn up and ask questions. You need to intervene into their town halls. You need to invite, you have your own town halls. And then you need to organise around healthcare. So they did. And the reason why, one of the key reasons why the healthcare bill first fell over, like remember how it fell over about 2 months ago?
All I can remember was an amazing celebration in the Rose Garden, Amanda. Are you saying there was more to it than that?
So remember in March the healthcare bill fell over. Well, probably the most significant reason why the Republicans refused to back this en masse, why it fell over, Trump pulled the bill,
they took
remember?
It off. Paul Ryan pulled it.
Paul Ryan pulled it, was because of indivisible. So there's this extraordinary grassroots, sort of centrally informed but very locally based grassroots movement across the United States organising around issues like healthcare.
Formed at a dinner party.
It's like the YouTube story. They just had a chat and then...
it reminds me actually of the Women's March on Washington, which is an extraordinary story of how being in the right place at the right time, you can just channel something. I can't remember her name, but there was a woman who basically put out a Facebook event post saying, this sucks, let's go to Washington and protest, went to sleep. By the morning, there were thousands of people on board, and a few weeks later, they were there, and some say they had more people than Donald Trump's inauguration. Fake news, but if you actually count, which of course we don't in America anymore, they had way more. Amazing story. Yeah.
Numbers are very left-wing, though, to be fair.
Yeah, Hindu and Arabic, aren't they? Yeah.
They are Arabic, yes.
Can I add, to the story of indivisible? One of the reasons why it's been effective, and one of the things that they learnt from the Tea Party in the US. Before the Tea Party was able to thwart everything Obama did, what it did was terrify Republicans. Its first principal aim was to enforce party discipline on Republicans in a country where party discipline is very difficult to enforce. The same thing has been happening here with Democrats. They realise that. There's not going to be any effective opposition to Trump, effective resistance to Trump, without party discipline among Democrats. You can't have scared people breaking ranks. And I think that they've done that. They've done that very effectively.
And Bernie Sanders, who isn't even a Democrat, is a big part of this story too. And we can only speculate what might have happened if he were the candidate. It's unlikely a choice, as he said. He's still less unlikely than Trump, and he actually had legislative experience. But it's interesting that there does seem to be almost for the first time in adversity, a massive left-wing popular movement that's really quite hardcore in terms of... There's not a lot of compromising going on. I mean, Bernie Sanders' healthcare plan is single-payer, what we have in Australia, and that... That is a you could never have said that, could you, David?
I disagree with that. There was there has been a single payer healthcare plan proposed in Congress every single year since the 1930s. Now, one of the major drivers for that was John Dingell, a Michigan Democrat, and it was his father before him. Single payer was Democratic Party orthodoxy until the 1990s, when Bill Clinton actually tried to do it. And this, the response to that was the Newt Gingrich-led Republican revolution in Congress, which is another thing that is one of the factors that really gave us the situation that we have today. You know, when after the mass shooting of Republican congressmen, which was a horrific event, we had Newt Gingrich coming out and saying, this is where the left has led us, they've got to turn down the violence. Like, no, Newt, this... situation of extreme polarisation combined with everyone has access to guns. No one is more responsible for that than Newt Gingrich, who was the leader of the House in the 1990s. That's what torpedoed single-payer healthcare the first time around. That's why when Barack Obama came in, he wasn't going for single-payer. I would definitely be in the camp of people who said that he should have had that as his opening negotiating position, the traditional Democratic Party tradition. But instead, he went with a plan that was devised by the Heritage Foundation in 1989, first implemented by Mitt Romney in 2006 as the conservative alternative to single payer. And he was demonised for it as a socialist. That is a lesson that people have learnt, or at least that's a lesson that people need to learn. There should not actually be anything stopping the Democratic Party from going back to single payer now.
Now, in terms of the Tea Party and these sort of movements, I want to ask about the kind of dark side of all of this. I was astonished this week to read that Steve Bannon, the director of strategy, always portrayed on SNL as an actual skeleton in a terrifying hood. He wants, as part of their health...
To be fair, the skeleton also has better skin than Steve Bannon.
Yeah, a healthy lifestyle. But he... It completely floored me. He thinks that the tax plan should include an increase for the top tier. He wants to see, apparently, a number four in terms of the percentage, so in the 40s rather than the 30s as it is now. What is this movement that's going on? Because it's not traditional republicanism. It's not really the Tea Party. It's another thing entirely. And I wonder if this is not actually going to get anywhere, or is this the new kind of form of the GOP that's coming through, the Bannonism that's somewhere close to Trump's soul in the mix, Dave?
Well, yeah, I mean, Bannon is a nationalist. He's an ethno-nationalist. And so, the you know, he probably does believe that rich white people should be taxed to pay for poor white people. At the same time, he will, you know, gut any kind of welfare provision, which he sees as having the taint of an ethnic minority. But I don't think that this is going to break Republican Party orthodoxy. I mean, low taxes is the single thing that unites most Republicans, including Trump. Bannon is a real outlier there. Bannon is another one of these people who is extremely politically naive and has never come to terms with the fact that Trump actually has to negotiate with Congress, a Congress that, you know, most of them signed pledges to Grover fucking Norquist, saying, I will never raise taxes. Do any of you even know who Grover Norquist is? He's... Okay, so some of you in the front row do.
He does have the best name of anybody.
Yeah, yeah. He's a complete nobody.
He's not the Grover from Sesame Street.
No. He's a complete nobody who has turned himself
Grover Peterson
into the most powerful person in American tax policy by virtue of the fact that he makes all of these Republicans sign this stupid pledge. It did appear that he was becoming marginalised within the Republican Party, and it looked like he was going to end his career as an advocate for vaping, which, for some reason, apart from low taxes, vaping is his major issue. But
Guy's given, got a lifestyle.
Yeah, given that we're seeing that really the core of the Republican healthcare reforms is a massive tax cut, I don't think that that particular part of the ethno-nationalist agenda is actually going to get anywhere.
But is there anything about vaping in it?
While we're talking naive and people who are close to Trump, Jared Kushner's a whole other story. the man responsible for solving the Middle East peace talks and also reforming the whole of the American government. What a champ. I'm interested, Amanda, in what this means for the left. And whenever one side is in the ascendancy, it kind of galvanises the other, as per the Tea Party with Clinton. Is this perhaps good for the left? I mean, sure, it's agonising in some respects, but in terms of kind of galvanising them and getting them on the one side, is this perhaps the outcome of this good for America's left?
So there's some real contradictions for the left in this experience. Like, actually, a lot of the stuff that you don't hear about in the press is legislation passing the Congress and the Senate that is terrible for the left, right? Like the expansion of right-to-work states destroying unions and stuff like that, right? Like literally just the destruction of collective organisation in progressive forces. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that isn't tweetable by Donald Trump. You know, the tweet happens over here and the terrible thing happens over here in silence, and there's a lot of that. That's a problem, right? I think there's an issue for the Democrats in this. So one of the issues, obviously, is, you know, will Trump be impeached? And maybe I don't want to jump the gun on... I'm sure you want to have a whole conversation about this.
Can't we just say no and move on? It's a bit of a dream.
It's a little bit... It is a bit of a dream, but it's a bit complex, right? How do you impeach someone? Well, you have to pass it by Congress. You're not going to pass it by a Republican Congress, but if the Democrats were to win the Congress in 2 years' time, then actually impeachment becomes interesting. So if you're the Democrats, do you, one, strategize to try and take out Congress and get a majority there so you can go for impeachment? Or do you go, chances of that, not that likely. We need to actually take the whole suite. We need to plan for 4 years or 3.5 years. Do we do that? In which case, if you're going for the long-term strategy or even the short-term strategy, you need a candidate. So there is a massive debate inside the Democrats at the moment in America between the Clintonites and the Sanderites, right? They're absolutely, fundamentally fractured.
Are they still, like, the candidates to
run? No, they're not the candidates. Think of them as the left and the right faction, right? You know, we wouldn't know that in Australia because our Labor Party doesn't have factions like that.
No factions here.
Yeah.
Right? It's exactly the same, right? So you've got the sort of, we need to be moderate, we need to appeal to a centrist base gang.
Third way.
Right?
Bill, yeah.
Right? Who have all the money behind them, right? So they're the ones who can raise the cash easily. That's where Clinton found her base. Or you've got Sanders. Now, Sanders is not going to be a candidate either, but Sanders is still being a political operative and he's got a movement around him. He's a mobilising force, absolutely. He's doing the sort of speaking tours around the country at the moment. And I look at it as an observer and I sort of, it makes me want to tear my hair out a little because surely, to me, the politics are that moderate centrism isn't the answer to politics at the moment in America, that actually the Democrats need someone that people can believe in, and that's not someone who's going to kowtow to the centre. Now, that doesn't mean you need... Bernie Sanders, the socialist, right? Like, I don't think he's the world's most awesome candidate. He did a good job, but having someone like an Elizabeth Warren or someone like that would be very, very interesting. But she's going to have a tough run to the White House, even if she was the candidate, because actually half the party don't believe that a sort of strong radical is worthwhile.
So Beyoncé is what you're saying.
Yeah, Beyoncé.
Well, or Oprah Winfrey, yeah, right? That's the other one that's done the
or Tom round. Hanks or The Rock. And look, all I'm going to say...
Look, I think The Rock is a solid plan.
All I'm going to say is that The Rock and Elizabeth Warren are Twitter buds. It's not him. Warren Johnson 2020. Dave, what do you think?
Although, actually, since Baywatch opened so weak, I don't know that The Rock is really a viable option at this point.
Don't doubt The Rock. Do not doubt The Rock. Anyway,
stop saying that to me.
He's fast and he's furious. Dave, what's your view on where the Democrats go from here? Because, I mean, it was an extraordinarily hopeless performance. And Clinton's strategy, in hindsight, looks worse than perhaps it actually was. What's their playbook from here? I mean, do they have... You'd think surely they have a chance in 2020, but I said that about getting Bush to be a one-term president. That didn't really work out. What do they do?
Well, I mean, if there's one benefit to Clinton losing, it's forced them to take a look at defects within the party that were papered over during the Obama era. And one of them is the neglect of politics at the local level. During Obama's presidency, Democrats lost 900 seats in state houses across America. Republicans now occupy 30 governor's mansions in the United States. Republicans actually have unified control of... they're five short of getting two-thirds of the country, at which point constitutional amendments begin to become potentially possible. Republicans built local infrastructure during the Obama era. They built it in, you know, very, very scammy ways. It was all based on scaring people that their guns were just about to be taken away or they were just about to be executed by an Obama death panel. But
they did a terrible job. Can I just say those death panels?
They took over a lot of
job creators.
Took over a lot of state legislatures. They won a lot of congressional races. And I'll just point out finally that actually presidents always preside over local losses by their party. And Democrats will be wanting the same thing to happen under Trump. Democrats have a chance now that they would not have had during a Clinton presidency to rebuild at the local level. Democrats need to start contesting things everywhere. Okay, and we've seen promising signs of that, of Democrats making races competitive in Montana and Georgia. They can't give up on white rural America. Those places that Trump won in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio, where he outperformed his polls by 15%, Obama was winning those counties by double digits twice in 2008 and 2012. And these aren't places which suddenly went cold on Obama. These are places where Obama is still popular, but Trump was winning them. Okay, why was this the case? Because Trump actually went to these places. Trump held rallies in these places where nothing ever happens. And, you know, Trump essentially told people the government can do something for you. The government,
you're going to get tired of winning, he said.
Yeah, yeah. The government can bring jobs back. The government can stop all of this free trade nonsense. The government can stop immigrants. Now,
but isn't that a huge problem for Democrats? Because if, I mean...
No, it's not. That's basically the right-wing version of yes, we can. And most people don't think in ideological categories. So what they were, you know, what they were hearing was Obama again. They were, you know, they were hearing someone affirmatively promising that the government could do something for them, which is not what they were hearing from Clinton. So Democrats, I mean, urban people and rural people, politically, they want about 80% of the same stuff. Okay, unfortunately, it's the 10% of the culture war that really, you know, tends to dominate the media. There's also about, you know, 10% of genuine distributive conflict between urban and rural. But fundamentally, a lot of these people want the same stuff. Jesse Jackson, the first really serious black candidate for governor, for president in the 1980s in the Democratic Party, did extraordinarily well in white rural America, going around to gatherings of farmers who are about to be kicked off their properties and, you know, saying the Democratic Party can do something for you. The Democrats have to be able to compete everywhere. They might not win everywhere, but they have to have a presence everywhere. They have to make it known that they haven't forgotten about the entire country, that they're not just the party of major cities.
Yeah, and I suppose the question is, who's the candidate? You were pointing at Elizabeth Warren, Amanda, and I can't. She in 3 years she may be getting towards the point of potentially being too old, but she's certainly one of the most prominent ones. Has anyone else caught your eye in terms of Democratic talent?
To be honest, I haven't seen anyone else. There are other candidates that are running around. She's interesting, right? Because she. She's a lawyer. She's based at Harvard. She radically embraced... There's a massive living wage campaign going on in the United States at the moment for a $15 minimum wage across the country, including at McDonald's. And I know that in Australia we sort of think, oh, why would people get paid such crap wages in the United States? And this is such a radical campaign to take on such a radical demand against such a big employer. And it's been a huge movement. She was the first politician to embrace it. It makes her interesting, right? Like, it makes her stand out from the crowd because she's not... She wasn't scared, right?
Yeah.
Like, she wasn't like your traditional Democrat. But I think irrespective of who the candidate is, I agree it's about local organising across the United States. And that's... And that's going to take party organising, right? The Democrats need to go local, they need to get organised. But they also need civil society in those places to be organised. They need, it needs the local churches and the local unions and the local community organisations to be acting together and organised in a way that they can complement a progressive politics. And that's going to need to happen. That has to happen over the next few years. I know, for instance, there's a national network in the United States called the Industrial Areas Foundation that's was set up by a guy called Saul Alinsky, who's all famous, you know, famously inspired most community organisers around the world. And that network has moved organisers to Wisconsin and Ohio with the aim of being able to set up some of that civil society infrastructure in the hope that in three years' time, when there is the next presidential election, there's a greater collection of people prepared to vote for a more progressive candidate.
Cory Booker, of any interest? Kamala Harris, any of these people?
I was into Cory Booker around 2007 or something like that.
I like his early stuff better.
He's been a total disappointment. Maybe he can redeem himself, but probably not. I agree with Amanda. I think that Elizabeth, and this is really worrying, that Elizabeth Warren is basically all there is at the moment.
So not Mark Zuckerberg.
He knows where we all live, literally. As someone who's dabbled in political satire, Al Franken, someone I'm a fan of, but
there's not a chance. He is so, I love him, so politically naive, not a chance.
Word for Trump? No, that's true. All right, we'll find out. Look, don't rule out Tom Hanks. Thank you for coming. Give yourselves a round of applause. Thank you for coming. Make America great again. And don't forget, the next live event is on Tuesday, the 1st of August. You can book giantdwarf.com.au. Heaps to talk about. One of the very special guests with whom to talk about. Thanks for joining us.